Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an education service to public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on smallpox when we come back. You know, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days. Now, here in America, we produce grain for export. Then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. And our food supply is now in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support the Global 2000 Population Reduction Program. Now, globalization may be good for business, but globalization is bad for you and it's bad for me. You know, back in 1940, we all had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year or more, and today we have a 3-day supply in our refrigerators. And we believe in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us all. But over the past 60 years, we have traded a 1-year supply of food for 3 days, and these Global 2000 mad scientists, these philosophers, these preachers and politicians plan to use famine, plague, disease, and pestilence to reduce Earth's population by over 90% over the next 50 years, or so says the Club of Rome. Now, these evil madmen with their Global 2000 genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for, and I say let them die for their cause and let you and I live for ours. So let me show you from the scripture how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. Now, to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, and entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, in the International Forecaster this week was another article which was entitled Smallpox. It says, our health article writer, Roger Mason, recommended that we put this article out. It comes from newsmax.com. If you want a copy of it, go to newsmax, N-E-W-S-M-A-X.com. Just published an article by Jim Myers on the need for mass smallpox vaccinations. So please look at it and consider putting this in your newsletter. The problem is that you can't get vaccinated for any amount of money. We even went to Bangkok, Thailand, to the Pasteur Institute to get smallpox vaccine. Well, a respected medical journal warns that the United States is highly vulnerable to a bioterror attack using the smallpox virus, and the best defense would be voluntary mass vaccination before such an attack. I want to pause here and underline voluntary mass vaccination. It goes on to say the alarming report appears in the summer 2006 edition of the Journal of the American Physicians and Surgeons. Smallpox was responsible for 300 million deaths worldwide in the 20th century before the World Health Organization declared that it was completely eradicated in 1980. But the U.S. government has reported that rogue nations such as Iran and North Korea have stocks of the smallpox virus. Ominously, in 1998, North Korean military defectors were found to have been recently vaccinated against smallpox. In the journal's featured article, Malik, the author, is an assistant professor at the Center for Homeland Security Studies at the University of Tennessee Graduate School of Medicine. Smallpox has already been used in biowarfare in previous centuries, according to Malik's report. The British, for instance, purposely supplied Native Americans with smallpox-infected blankets during the French and Indian War. Confederate sympathizers during the Civil War sold smallpox-infected clothing to Union troops. And during the 1930s, the Japanese experimented with smallpox in Manchuria. The United States is probably the most likely target for a bioterrorist attack, but the effects of such an attack would not be limited to this country alone, Malik writes. Given the availability of rapid international travel, an infectious bioterror outbreak could quickly spread throughout the world. Current response plans call for isolating any cases of smallpox quickly by vaccinating those closest to the infected persons, known as ring vaccination, and then vaccinating the rest of the population. This approach, however, is not likely to work, the expert believes, because of such factors as the rapid and extensive travel of the American public and the absence of any herd immunity. By the time a single case of smallpox is diagnosed anywhere in the United States, it would mean that the entire nation has potentially been exposed and that the whole world is at risk. Malik's analysis of the smallpox threat is chilling, and he says that given the contagiousness of the disease, it is reasonable and conservative to expect that one infected person would infect three others on average. Between an initial bioterror attack and the time that the disease is first diagnosed, bioterrorists could initially expose 1,000 people to smallpox in an attack involving a group of terrorists who become infected with the virus before entering the United States and then disperse themselves across the country. Aerosolized dissemination of the virus could also be used, exposing the terrorists to less risk and their command structure to less exposure. Now, assuming the traditionally accepted likelihood that a third of those exposed would contract the disease, then at least 300 people would become infected. It might be conservatively and optimistically hoped that the disease will be diagnosed during that first epidemiological cycle of exposure. In that best-case scenario, only one additional person would contract the disease from an infected individual after the first epidemiological cycle, meaning 300 new cases for a total of at least 600. Further, assuming the traditional accepted likelihood that a third of those who contract the disease would die, then at least 200 deaths would result from the first two epidemiologic cycles in such a conservative scenario. The United States is well aware of this problem, and in 2001, a bioterrorism exercise conducted by the federal government, which was dubbed Dark Winter, revealed that because it takes up to 2 weeks for smallpox to produce recognizable symptoms, the disease was able to spread to 25 states in that short period of time. The scenario resulted in the theoretical death of 1 million and incapacitation of 2 million others. The ensuing epidemic quickly overwhelmed the medical system, and vaccinations were too late for many people. The U.S. economy ground to a halt as frightened citizens shut themselves indoors. Dr. Stephen Cantrill, the head of emergency medicine in Denver, Colorado, said that due to the multiple pressures that have been put upon our hospitals, they have no surge capacity. They could not adjust to a sudden increase in patient load without degenerating into chaos. A germ warfare attack would make our 1918 influenza epidemic, with a case fatality rate of 2% and more than 67,000 deaths, truly look like a walk in the park, he added. Senator Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, said at the time that he believed the risk of a smallpox attack is so great that he would immediately get his four grandchildren vaccinated. Specter said he also believes the government shouldn't stockpile the vaccine, but give citizens the right to decide for themselves if they want to get the vaccination. Again, boys and girls, I'm going to underline voluntary. Now, the last time the fears of a smallpox attack received widespread press coverage came in the run-up to the war in Iraq, when the United States, fearing Saddam Hussein might arm terrorists with deadly germs before a U.S. attack, ordered 40 million doses of smallpox vaccine from the British company. The following year, Israel, expressing those same fears, began vaccinating its citizens, starting with 1,500 healthcare workers. Now, there's no question about the need for immunization against smallpox if the virus is to be used as a biological weapon, according to Malik. I'm going to underline the words, there is no question about the need for immunization. The question is, should we wait for an outbreak before beginning these vaccinations, or should we institute a voluntary vaccination program before a potential outbreak? Again, I will underline voluntary vaccination program. Malik argues for the latter course, and he notes that there is a relatively low risk to the controlled vaccination of the U.S. population before an outbreak. In 1968, the last year of universal vaccination here in the United States, 14.2 million people were vaccinated, and there were only 9 deaths attributed to vaccination-related complications. Also, recent medical advances have made complications more unlikely and easier to treat. I'm going to underline only 9 deaths. Vaccination before an outbreak would be far preferable to the confusion of a panicked, rapid mass vaccination program following an attack. As Malik puts it, any potential complications of smallpox vaccination would be much better handled in the calm situation of controlled vaccination over an extended period of time, rather than within the crisis of a bioterror attack. So Malik concludes that, I believe that medical, geopolitical, and psychological factors determine that fewer disease casualties and vaccine complications would occur with preemptive vaccinations than with mass vaccination after an outbreak, and that reliance on the ring vaccination concept alone is almost certain to fail. Let me underline almost certain to fail. So we have officials of the government. This is Mr. Malik, who is an official with the Homeland Security people, put out an article. It was picked up by Bob Chapman and put into the International Forecaster. If you'd like a copy of the article, this comes from Jim Myers, Newsmax, N-E-W-S-M-A-X, Newsmax. And they're located at www.newsmax.com. It was published in the International Forecaster in the June 29th, 06 midweek edition of the International Forecaster, which you can contact them on their webpage at www.theinternationalforecaster.com. And that's all one word, theinternationalforecaster.com. 88% of people in the United States believe in vaccination. 12% do not. I'm in that 12% that do not believe in vaccination, and I intend to avoid vaccination, if it's at all possible, except for being knocked down, handcuffed, drugged, and then vaccinated against my will and over my objection while I'm kicking and screaming in my sleep. I'm not going to get a vaccination. Now, after reading this article, you may say, well, my God, Gordon, you have to be a madman. Why, only a madman would fail to go down and protect himself and his family. You'd have to hate your children not to have them vaccinated against this potential threat of smallpox. Now, it's because I love my children that I'm not going to get them vaccinated. And I'm so selfish and so self-centered and concerned about myself and myself only that I'm going to protect myself against vaccination by avoiding it like AIDS, herpes, and VD. So let me tell you why. Smallpox declined before vaccination was enforced. Now, you should mistake, or to mistake inferences or axioms for facts has been a curse of science. Now, everybody accepts vaccination. How many people have ever questioned it? I think that you should have an inquisitive and a questioning mind. Maybe vaccination is the greatest thing since sliced white bread. But did it ever occur to you that instead of accepting it because everybody else accepts it, like lemmings jumping into the ocean, maybe we should ask questions about vaccination, find out a little more about it. The simple fact that we have less smallpox now than we did 200 years ago does not in any degree prove that vaccination caused this decline in smallpox. Although the promoters of vaccination have been quick to take it upon themselves to take full credit for this improvement. Now, the most noticeable decrease in smallpox and other zymotic diseases began with the sanitation reforms just prior to 1800 and the improvement in nutrition brought about by such health crusaders as Trawl, Graham, and Jennings around 1840. And this sanitation and health improvement program included sewage disposal, cleaning of streets, cleaning of backyards, cleaning of stables, etc., and the improvement of roads so that fresh vegetables, milk, and other vital foods could be transported rapidly to the cities and distributed while they were still fresh. And the water supply was improved and protected from contamination, and housing projects were built out in the suburbs to relieve congestion and population in the inner cities. These five events did more to reduce smallpox than all the vaccinations that have ever been given in total. Now, the nutritional teachings stressed natural whole grain bread instead of white bread, fresh fruits and vegetables free from salt, sugar, chemicals, and other harmful preservatives, and the rejection of coffee, tea, alcohol, tobacco, drugs, and other poisons. Meat and other low-grade proteins were denounced in favor of nuts, beans, and other such proteins with more health value and less toxic effects. The age-old terror diseases, such as plague, black death, cholera, etc., that were previously believed to be contagious, responded at once to this health program and soon declined to the vanishing point in countries that adopted the sanitation and nutrition improvements. And they are diseases of nutritional deficiency and imbalance, just the same as all other diseases. And a glance at the following table of official statistics from England and Wales shows us how smallpox deaths declined only after the people began their opposition to the vaccination law and an ever-increasing number refused to be vaccinated. In the period of 1872 to 1881, the percentage of children vaccinated for smallpox was 96.5%, and the death rate per million was 3,708.3. So if you've got a pen and paper out there, let's jot that down. Compulsory vaccination was introduced into England in 1853. From 1853 into 1870, the people were, under compulsory vaccination, mostly vaccinated. Children, at the rate of 96.5% by 1872 to 1881, produced just under 4,000 smallpox deaths. In the period from 1882 to 1891, during the period when the people began to refuse to take vaccinations, the number of people vaccinated dropped from 96.5% to 82.1%. And with the drop in the number of people vaccinated, the number of smallpox deaths dropped from 4,000 to less than 1,933. In the period from 1892 to 1901, only 67% of the people were vaccinated. So now, with fewer people vaccinated, you would naturally expect the death rate from smallpox to go up. Nope, it doesn't go up, it goes down. It goes down to 436, or about half of the number that were reported in 1882 to 91. Again, from 1912 to 1921, with only 42% of the people vaccinated, the death rate drops to 12.2 per million. In the period from 1932 to 1941, with less than 40% of the people vaccinated, the death rate from smallpox dropped to 1.4 per million. So here we have, from the government statistics over a period of 100 years, the fact that when fewer people are vaccinated, there are fewer deaths from smallpox. So after I did my homework and I did my research, I look at those numbers and I say, well, why would I want to be vaccinated when the death rate goes up among the people who are vaccinated and goes down among the group of people that is unvaccinated? Now, should you avoid vaccinations in general? Gee, that's kind of a wild thought. Should you avoid vaccinations? American children are vaccinated at an ever-increasing rate. In fact, here in the United States, vaccination rates are now at the highest they've ever been in history. By the time a child is 5 years old, he has had 36 vaccinations, beginning at age 2 months. 36 vaccinations. And these vaccines contain such deadly toxic poisons as thimerosal and aluminum. Aluminum has been connected with Alzheimer's disease. Remember that? Now, I'm looking for a piece of paper here on vaccines, and I seem to have succeeded in losing it. Take a look here at flu crimes. Here it is, right here. Here's a neat little piece of paper. The CDC states that 135 children died during the 2003-2004 flu season. 59 of these children had received their flu shots. That's 43%. So of the number of children who died from the flu, 43% of them had been vaccinated. Well, then, that sends me a signal, and it says, well, being vaccinated, at least 43% of the time, does not protect you from death. Well, 43%, boys and girls, is pushing up toward 50-50, and 50-50 is like flipping a coin. You know, you can flip a coin, and half the times it'll come up heads, and half the time it'll come up tails. What that really says is that if I were vaccinated, half the time I would die from the flu, and half the time I wouldn't. Boys and girls, I'm already 67, I've never had the flu, and I've never had a flu shot. I'm already batting 100%. There's no reason for me to go out and get a flu shot and reduce the odds to 50-50. Is there? Now, it's just too much for the CDC to suggest that patients exercise and eat right. They would rather promote vaccines that contain dangerous chemicals and inject that into babies rather than promote good health. Well, Dr. Hugh Fundenberg, one of the most quoted biologists of our time, says that if an individual has 5 consecutive flu shots, that his or her chances for developing Alzheimer's disease are 10 times greater than if they had 1, 2, or no shots. I'm going to bracket that paragraph and read it to you again. Maybe you've never heard this before, so if you haven't heard it before, then you ought to listen up. There's a fellow by the name of Dr. Hugh Fundenberg. You probably never heard the name, neither have I, but they tell us that he's one of the most quoted biologists of our time. So he says that if an individual has 5 consecutive flu shots, and let's back up here a little bit, boys and girls, if you had 5 consecutive flu shots in 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, and 2005, okay, 5 consecutive flu shots in 5 seasons, then your chances of getting Alzheimer's disease are 10 times greater than if you had had just 1 shot, or had had just 2 shots in 5 years, or if you had had no shots at all. So I fall into that last group. My chances of developing Alzheimer's disease is 10 times less because I did not have a flu shot 5 consecutive years in a row. I like that. I have avoided flu shots. I will continue to avoid flu shots in the future. Now, what it will do to babies, given after years and years, is anybody's guess. But the CDC is recommending that your babies be given a flu shot every year. And that's exactly what it is. It's a guess. It's an experiment. Nobody knows what that's going to do to babies. We know what it does to people who are advanced in years, that if they have five shots in a row for 5 years, they stand a 10 times greater chance of getting Alzheimer's disease. What that's going to do to a baby at age 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 20, 21, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, having a flu shot every single year. Nobody knows. Nobody's experimented. Nobody's tested. It's an experiment. It's a crapshoot. So what I want to do is to sit back and watch you vaccinate your children every year for the next 30 or 40 years. Then I want to be able to observe the outcome. I want you to experiment with you and your children so that I can see how the experiment comes out. If you get a good result, maybe I'll consider some flu shots. If you get a bad result, then I'll let you suffer so that I don't have to. I think that's a good plan. I like it already. Now, with an already heavy childhood immunization schedule in place and children carrying heavy burdens of toxins, including mercury administered through other vaccines, it's a gamble as to what will happen to children under the CDC's rule with the addition of the flu vaccine that contains thimerosal. Of course, experimenting with children or anyone else is against the laws of humanity and certainly a serious breach of medical ethics. Ah, come on. Now, when did anybody in government or anybody in medicine give a rat's you-know-what concerning ethics? The addition of the flu vaccine into the childhood immunization schedule, loaded as it is with nasty chemicals like mercury, aluminum, and even formaldehyde, reveals the CDC's true colors as a terrorist organization whose prime target is children. If not medical terrorists, we would have to see them as medically ignorant, or even worse, as being medically insane. All right, so those are your flu crimes at the CDC. Now, I'm not here to tell you not to get your flu shots and not to vaccinate your children. I don't care whether you vaccinate your children or not. I just don't want my children vaccinated, and I don't want to be vaccinated, and that's the problem that I see for people like us, the minority, that 12%. It's the evangelistic zeal that is expressed by the majority in their firm belief that vaccine is good for them, and therefore it's good for us. It's like religious people, you know. They're convinced that they've been born again, that they're going to heaven, and that they have a vision of Jesus, and they want to share that with you and me. God bless them all. I just don't like it forced upon me. I just want to kind of choose for myself. And then when I reject it and I go to hell, it's not your fault. You did everything you could to convince me to give my heart to Jesus. And if I don't do it, then it's my problem in life, not yours. You gave me the message. I accepted your message. I weighed your message. I rejected your message. And I should pay the full penalty for my decision. I should bear the full responsibility for my decision. So when I don't get my smallpox vaccination, and I come down with smallpox, and I die from smallpox, it's not your fault. Let me take full responsibility for my actions. And you butt out of my life, and don't you take any responsibility for my actions. How's that for plan? Hey, let me give you a reminder. And that is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear in this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the law or an editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, here's an article from Spiker. Let me give you a couple of citations here. Flu crimes at the CDC is an article taken from Mercola.com. That's www.mercola.com. Flu crimes at the CDC. Let's give them credit for their work. And then Spiker wrote an 8-page article on why you should avoid taking vaccines. Spiker at Interfold.com. It's a Spiker at Interfold.com. I-N-T-E-R-F-O-L-D. I don't know what that means. I don't know how to get onto the web anyway, and I have to leave that up to our technical staff. But just telling you, Spiker is a news source, and we get a lot of articles here from Spiker, S-P-I-K-E-R. I imagine if you plug that into a search engine, they probably give it to you. What you're looking for here, it was dated 12-8-03. That's when we pulled this one out. It's been in my vaccine file for a few years. Why you should avoid taking vaccines. Oh, here we go. www.newswithviews.com. www.newswithviews.com. The article entitled Why You Should Avoid Taking Vaccines by Dr. James Hauenstein, MD. He's got a webpage here. It's an email address. It says J-I-M-H-O-W, Jim Howe, at rasca.co.cr. Once more, that's J-I-M-H-O-W at, you know that at sign, rasca.co.cr. All right, Dr. James R. Shannon, former director of the National Institute of Health, declared the only safe vaccine is one that's never used. Cowpox vaccine was believed able to immunize people against smallpox. At the time this vaccine was introduced, there was already a decline in the number of cases of smallpox. Japan introduced compulsory vaccination in 1872. 20 years later, in 1892, there were 165,000 cases of smallpox with 30,000 deaths despite the vaccination program. Much of the success attributed to vaccination programs may actually have been due to improvement in public health related to water quality and sanitation, less crowded living conditions, better nutrition, and higher standards of living. Typically, the incidence of a disease was clearly declining before the vaccine for that disease was introduced. Let me repeat that. Typically, the incidence of any disease was clearly declining before the vaccine for that disease was introduced. And in England, the incidence of polio had already decreased by 82% before the polio vaccine was introduced in 1956. All right, let's think about that for a minute. Remember polio? My buddy Eddie O'Neill got polio. He's the only kid that I knew of that I was close to that got polio. And the general consensus of opinion was that Eddie was walking down the street. And on one side was George Gordon, and on the other side was David Wagner. And as we were walking down the street, we were breathing in and breathing out. And unbeknownst to the three of us, walking down the street, there was a polio virus in the air. And one of us, Eddie, breathed it in. And he was just unlucky. Could have been any of us. That's the conventional theory. Is that the way diseases spread? Well, in some cases, you can sneeze across the room and you can infect somebody across the room. And the strange part of it is that when the guy sneezes and infects two or three people in the room, there were 30 other people in the room that didn't get infected. Has anybody ever wondered why? One guy sneezes and he's got some infectious disease. Three people pick up the disease. 27 other people are in the room. They don't get the disease. Why is that? Ever heard of your immune system? Immune system. Immunity. Natural immunity. Well, in the early 1900s, an astute Indiana physician, his name was W.B. Clark, made this observation. In fact, he made this observation in 1911. I'm familiar with Dr. Clark's book. Dr. Clark said cancer was practically unknown until compulsory vaccination with cowpox vaccine began to be introduced. And I have had to deal with 200 cases of cancer over the past 11 years, and I never saw a case of cancer in an unvaccinated person. Did you get that, children? In 1911, Dr. W.B. Clark said that over 11 years, from 1900 to 1911, he treated 200 cases of cancer. He said the incidence of cancer was practically unheard of prior to 1900 in his little town in cancer in Indiana. He said, we don't have cancer here. In 11 years, he treated 200 people in his community for cancer. He says, I never treated a single person for cancer that was unvaccinated. Every cancer victim had been vaccinated. All right. Now, remember when we started tonight's program, I said, I'm going to avoid vaccinations like AIDS, herpes, and VD. This is one more reason for me to avoid vaccination. I haven't been vaccinated. I don't have cancer. and I would like to live for another 30 or 40 years without getting cancer. And I'm well on my way. I've got a 67-year head start on a lot of you people out there. So I'm going to avoid vaccination. Now, you people watch. And if I can live 30 or 40 more years without getting cancer, it will validate Dr. W.B. Clark's observation that he made clear back in 1911. Now, there's a widely held belief that vaccines should not be criticized because the public might refuse to take them. This is valid only if the benefits exceed the known risks of the vaccines. So do vaccines actually prevent disease? 88% of the American public firmly believe it. But is it true just because you believe it? You know, have you ever believed something and then found out later that what you believed was not true? Has that ever happened to you? It's happened to me so often that I'm gun-shy. Boy, when somebody tells me something, I got to prove it. I've got to sit down and look at the facts. You know, the same thing here with vaccines. I'm fully familiar with the majority herd instinct that vaccinations must be good because everybody's doing it. I'm not fully persuaded that that's true. Not fully persuaded at all. In fact, I have discovered in my lifetime that you stand a greater chance of being wrong than being right. And that's because truth plus truth equals truth. And error plus error equals error. And truth plus error equals, think about it now, truth plus error equals what? Error. Well, if error plus error equals error and truth plus error equals error, then your chances are 67% being incorrect and only 33% being correct. So that's just about what I've observed in my lifetime. About a third of the time, you'll be right, and about two-thirds of the time, you'll be wrong. And so it's kind of important that you investigate. So I investigated vaccines. I investigated the subject matter. My conclusion is vaccines are bad for me. Boys and girls, I don't know if vaccines are bad for you or not. I don't make choices for you. You're an adult, make your own. But do vaccines actually prevent disease? Well, this important question does not appear to have ever been adequately studied. Vaccines are enormously profitable for drug companies, and recent legislation in the United States has exempted lawsuits against pharmaceutical firms in the event of adverse reactions to vaccines, which are very common. In 1975, Germany stopped requiring pertussis, that is, whooping cough vaccination. Today, less than 10% of German children are vaccinated against pertussis, and the number of cases of pertussis has actually decreased in Germany, even though far fewer children are receiving pertussis vaccine. So in Germany, they did a little study. They figured out that if you don't vaccinate children for pertussis, the fewer people you vaccinate, the less pertussis you have. Now, that fits right in with my thinking. I haven't had it, and I don't expect to get it. And I haven't been vaccinated for it, and I'm going to avoid the vaccinations, and according to the German study, I'm on the right track. And the 88% of you who are rushing out to get your pertussis vaccine are on the wrong track. Well, assuming, of course, that you don't want to get pertussis. So it may be that you want to get pertussis, that that's your goal in life. Well, then one of the best ways to do that is to get vaccinated, and you'll stand a greater chance of developing the disease. Measles outbreaks have occurred in schools with vaccination rates over 98% in all parts of the United States, including areas that had reported no cases of measles for years. As measles immunization rates rise to the high levels that measles becomes a disease seen only in vaccinated persons. An outbreak of measles occurred in a school where 100% of the children had been vaccinated. Measles mortality rates had declined by 97% in England before measles vaccination was instituted. So by the time they started the measles vaccine program in England, it had already declined, you know, the incidence of it, the death rate from it, 97%. And so now they start vaccinating all these children and say, well, now, see, my God, measles vaccination saved Britain from a measles epidemic. What a crock of BS. Boys and girls, if something has decreased, like the American dollar, by 97%, you know, for practical purposes, it's a done deal. It's already been destroyed. So when measles has already declined by 97%, children, wake up. You know, for practical purposes, it's eradicated. Now, I don't want to tell you not to get your vaccine. I'm not here to take sides one way or the other. I'm a reporter, remember? I'm just here to report facts. In 1986, there were 1,300 cases of pertussis in Kansas, and 90% of those cases occurred in children who had been adequately vaccinated. Well, let me back up here for a minute. 1,300 cases of pertussis in Kansas among 90% of the cases in vaccinated children. 90% of the time, boys and girls, the pertussis vaccine does not protect you from pertussis. And it's a pure speculative observation that it protects 10% of the people from pertussis. That's just pure speculation. But even if it were true, it was absolute gospel that you could take to the bank and deposit it. I wouldn't take a pertussis vaccine because 90% of the time I'm going to develop pertussis and only 10% of the time is the vaccine going to protect me if, in fact, that's what is protecting me. It could be your immune system or something else. Hell, it could be the Jack Daniels you're drinking or the Camel cigarettes that you're smoking. For all you know, there certainly isn't any evidence that the 10% that didn't get pertussis got it because of the vaccine. 90% of those that were vaccinated got it. So somebody's going to say, yeah, but millions of children didn't get it. What in the hell does that prove? Millions of children in Kansas didn't get bubonic plague either, but they hadn't been vaccinated against bubonic plague, had they? You know, here in America, our ability to think, it's what my old granddaddy used to say, common sense, has materially declined over the past 50 years. Materially declined. Common sense. After institution of diphtheria vaccination in England and Wales in 1894, all right, got this, 1894, Great Britain, here comes Parliament and the Prime Minister and the government and the health ministry and the health agencies and the doctors and hospitals and all the people, 1894 in England and Wales, they instituted diphtheria vaccination. The number of deaths from diphtheria rose by 20% in the next 15 years. So they instituted diphtheria vaccination in 1894. Over the next 15 years, the incidence, the death rate, incidence from diphtheria rose by 20%. Okay. Well, listen, most people don't get diphtheria anyway. So most people aren't affected by diphtheria. So if the death rate goes up by 20%, it's kind of an innocuous statistic to start with. But listen, going out and getting a diphtheria vaccination costs money, takes time, effort, and energy, and increases your chances of dying from diphtheria by 20%. I don't see any logic in going out and spending my time, effort, and energy, and money to get vaccinated so that I can increase the chances of dying from this disease by 20%. Hell, I can die, boys and girls, without spending any money at all. Children, it doesn't cost anything to die. You sure as hell don't have to spend any time, effort, and energy working at it. It's going to happen. I'm trying to prevent death. I'm trying to ward it off as long as possible. I'm trying to live to be 110. Why in the hell would I want to go out and get a diphtheria vaccination and increase my odds by 20%? Now, the continued presence of these infectious diseases in children who have received vaccines proves that lifelong immunity, which follows natural infection, does not occur in persons who receive these vaccines. The injection process places the viral particles into the bloodstream without providing any clear way to eliminate these foreign substances. So why do these vaccines fail to protect against disease? Well, Wayleen James, author of Immunization, The Reality Behind the Myth, states that the full inflammatory response is necessary to create real immunity. Prior to the introduction of measles and mumps vaccines, children got measles and mumps, and in the great majority of cases, these diseases were benign. The vaccines trick the body so it does not mount a complete inflammatory response to the injected virus. Now, I had measles and mumps, and I so far have had lifelong immunity. That's the way we used to do it in the old days. All you had to do is sit back and relax. You didn't have to spend any money on vaccines, and you would get the measles at some point in time. You'd be incapacitated for 2 or 3 days, and you'd get up off of your measles bed, and you would have lifelong immunity from measles. That's me. That's little Georgie Gordon. I've got that. So we woke up one day and said, well, my God, what we need to do is to trick the body's immune response, and we need vaccines against measles so that we can make more money for the pharmaceutical industry. And that's, after all, the primary purpose for vaccines is bottom-line profits for big pharma. And I'm not opposed to that. Millions of people have pharmaceutical stocks, and they make their livings, or they make money off of the dividends that come from these stocks, and millions of people work for these companies. Far be it from me to tell you not to get a vaccine. I'm just pointing out that these vaccines don't accomplish, for George Gordon, the intended goal of living to be 110 disease-free. It increases my risk of getting a disease and dying before I'm 110. The incidence of sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, has grown from 0.55 per 1,000 live births, that's about one half, or about one out of 2,000 live births in 1953, to 13 per 1,000 in 1992 in Olmsted County, Minnesota. So from one death per 2,000 live births in 1953, you now have 26 deaths per 2,000 live births in 1992. That's a pretty significant increase in SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. The peak incidence for SIDS is age 2 to 4 months, the exact time most vaccines are being given to children. 85% of cases of SIDS occur in the first 6 months of infancy. The increase in SIDS as a percentage of total infant deaths has risen from 2.5 per 1,000 in 1953 to 17.9 per 1,000 in 1992. And this rise in SIDS deaths has occurred during a period when nearly every childhood disease was declining due to improved sanitation and medical progress, except SIDS. These deaths from SIDS did increase during a period when the number of vaccines given a child was steadily rising to 36 vaccinations per child by age 5. In Japan, back in the 70s, they took a look at that, and so they postponed the vaccination program from age 2 months to 2 years. They still give the same poisons to little Japanese children that you Americans do to your little babies at age two, but the incidence of SIDS, S-I-D-S, sudden infant death syndrome, dropped by half by postponing that for 2 years. Well, did it ever occur to the Japanese that if you eliminated vaccinations, you could eliminate sudden infant death syndrome? That hasn't struck anybody over there yet. They've been able to cut it by half by postponing the vaccine schedule from age 2 months to 2 years. Here in America, we start vaccinations at age 2 months, and by 2 years, we've probably shot this kid up with 15 or 20 vaccines. And if he doesn't have autism yet, or if he doesn't or hasn't died already from sudden infant death syndrome, maybe he will die from cancer or some other disease later on in life caused by the same vaccines. And now the other day here in the United States, they came up with a new vaccine to protect young children. They're going to give it to young children ages 9 to 13 to prevent uterine cancer or ovarian cancer, I forget which. And I suspect, like most of these vaccines and these new medical breakthroughs that are announced with great hoopla and fanfare, about 5 or 10 years from now, you'll find out that these little girls are developing heart attacks at age 16, or they're developing breasts on their buttocks or something. You know, there'll be some horrible result that comes from this vaccination program, which has always been produced by these medical breakthroughs over time. Nah, shucks, kids, I think I'll just pass. You go ahead and you go out and get these vaccines for me, would you? And write me an email. Say, hey, listen, Gordon, I went out and I got my vaccines, and I've got my little girl shot up with this new vaccine. That's terrific. And let's watch your child. Let's watch your child die from SIDS. Let's watch your kid develop autism. Let me watch your kid develop cancer. No sense in both of us suffering at the same time. Let's go ahead and test it and see what works. Well, we're about out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, is heard 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.